Welcome to another episode of Leading Edge from AerospaceNews.com. I'm Craig, editor of AerospaceNews.com and host of Leading Edge. I recently spoke to the delightful pilot Emily. She is an airline captain from Toronto, Canada, an Instagrammer and YouTuber. We're going to discuss her experiences becoming a pilot and her time flying for the United Nations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Spoiler alert, there be tummy troubles ahead. For now, grab a beverage, maybe some Pepto-Bismol, and strap in. The show starts right after this.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hi.
Oh, it's really, really thrilled to have you here.
I'm super pumped you could have me, and thank you so much for asking me to be a guest.
Well, you have a wonderful, positive, adventure-seeking personality, so it's our privilege and honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you once again.
You were warned about our Check 6 round at the beginning.
Yes.
To get a little appetizer for the Emily that's not just Pilot Emily. So let's run through a few quick questions. Obviously, there's not a lot of explanation needed, but if you have a funny or important piece of background information you think we should know to explain your answer, fire away. I normally begin with this because this is one of those filters that sort of says something about someone's personality and their preferences. And it's a really nerdy question, so I apologize if it seems that way in advance, but you are a pilot who likes airplanes and high technology, so this might be like exactly in your wheelhouse. Star Wars, Star Trek, or The Expanse?
I'm super happy you included The Expanse. I'm going to have to go with that one, yes.
There are some really wonderful characters from an extremely broad background in that show.
And the science and accuracy behind it, I was like, I can get behind that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like Star Trek's universe rebooted with reality and less magic.
And I will say that I will be a Star Wars fan at heart, like deep down always. But The Expanse was just like, something new to watch, which was great.
Yeah, so I think Star Wars captures the romance and Star Trek is sort of the documentary adventure made real-ish. You know, it's speculative fiction, but The Expanse was gritty and almost like time travel. Like this might be our not too distant future.
Exactly.
Go to karaoke song.
Oh my God. It's going to have to be, I can't even think. It's going to have to be like Spice Girls. If you want to be my lover.
Oh no.
Or like anything from like 2000s, I feel like it's going to bring the kid in me for sure.
Oh, to 2000s, that's in the time before. Yeah, that's.
Well, 90s to 2000s, right? Yeah.
Well, we won't even talk about what the music was popular when I was a kid, except that the sheet music had to be unscrolled from the ancient the ancient texts.
Still in hieroglyphics, yeah.
Extraterrestrial life, or are humans alone in the universe, do you think?
I don't think we're alone, personally. Have you heard of, we can talk about this later, but have you heard of, you know, Kutzka's Art, right? The YouTube channel?
Of course. Oh my goodness, yes.
Okay. So have you heard of the Great Filter? The theory behind the Great Filter?
Yeah, it's called American Political Process.
So I feel like we're not, I feel like we're not alone in the universe. But I feel like it's really daunting to think whether or not we're like ahead or behind that great filter. But we can talk about it later again if it needs more.
Okay. Well, my mind is completely blown that you dropped Kutzka's on which also is known as In a Nutshell for those folks that are not familiar with it. But I've actually been spamming people recently, who are friends of mine. It's like, you've got to go watch this particular video about this channel. And actually, for those that are having a difficult time coping right now, there's a video on their channel that talks about, I think the title is, this will show you how much of a Kutzka nerd I am, Cure for Dissatisfaction.
Okay, wasn't there also one with loneliness, I think, maybe recently? Yeah.
There's also that one as well. Yeah. Both of those are they're non-therapeutics in the sense that they're not actual medical advice, but they deal with how to cope when one is feeling mentally adrift and out of sorts and stressed by the circumstances they find themselves in. So, wow, Emily, wow. not surprised, but really pleasantly impressed.
I'm a big nerd.
Taking this in an entirely different intellectual direction, man buns, acceptable or a fashion crime?
Fashion crime.
Okay. I mean, unless you're an actual sumo wrestler or sure, like a samurai,
yes,
but yeah, on somebody that looks like me, for example, no, in my view. Yeah. Not so much. Just two more and the check ride's over. Actually, I should change this instead of check six to the check ride.
Yeah, there you go.
Your favorite airplane?
I get asked this all the time. It's boring, but the 747, like kind of obviously, right? But it's just a beautiful airplane. Like, it's just, I really wish I could have been around to fly that thing. He's so beautiful.
I'm sorry, that goes back to Skrulls. Yes.
But they're retiring so many of them nowadays, right? So
yeah. Yeah, I have seen people before this most recent wave of retirements that have purchased old scrap airplanes and turned them into things like hillside homes and all that. And there's a part of me that says, well, that sounds kind of fun and cool, especially if you could get them, you know, for pennies on the dollar. The 747 is one of those things that's big enough that you could probably actually have a kind of a cool home jammed up into a hillside somewhere, like out of a James Bond movie.
They make keychains with parts of them, like actual registration and everything. So if you really want to nerd out, that's an avenue you can explore.
So you're not an A380 fan over the 747. I because you're from Canada, I thought maybe there might have been a more EU-oriented loyalty there.
I will be straight up honest, and most people who follow me on Instagram know this, I am not this like huge plane geek. Like it's always been for myself, it's always been about the flying, right? Like so much more. And I can appreciate it. Like once I learn about the aircraft that I'm flying, like I get really passionate about it. And you know, you learn all the systems, so it kind of comes with the territory. Sure. But in terms of like plane spotting and like knowing every single aircraft, like I would look to my first officers and be like, do you know what kind of plane that is? Because I wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards that. So that's why I say like the 747 is kind of like an easy answer. Mm. But, you know, I have such an appreciation for like just all aircraft, really.
It is still my favorite airliner for sure. 747. Mm-hmm. I am old enough that I grew up and my dad would fly on TWA 707s going to New York and back on business. And they had this little, they had an antenna coming out of the top of the vertical stabilizer aiming forward. Just something about watching that pivot on the taxiway, you know, there was an elegance to that and the lighting, right? I mean, you could, it's like a romance about that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
At least to me, you know, as a child in the 1860s.
Fossil.
Okay.
Parent fossil.
Last question, and this one I wrote specifically for you, although I believe I should stipulate that this is not necessarily Toronto focused.
Okay.
I'm not that much of an ignorant United Stadian but poutine, Nirvana, yeah, or proof of Satan abroad in the land?
Oh my God. Poutine, Nirvana, or... Poutine is delicious. This is hard. I mean, I do love I feel like I'm just going to go with poutine. That stuff is just delicious.
Okay, so it's not terrible. You like it. That was
the point. Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Because some people look at it and think, that looks like a dog's breakfast, you know?
No. It's delicious.
I believe In-N-Out Burger you know who they are down here. Yes. Yeah, it was inspired by that poutine because they do offer fries with a bunch of stuff dumped on top of them. I must admit, I enjoy eating with like a bunch of stuff, but I know poutine comes in crazy varieties and people make it with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a poutine shake or something like that.
There are so many different varieties, like just like having like extra toppings on top of it or like different types of gravies. So like you can get pretty creative with them.
Okay, turning to a slightly more serious style of conversation, what sparked your interest in aviation and when did that happen?
I see, this is probably related to me not being like a crazy plane like enthusiast, because it happened when I was a bit older. So it was my second career. I've been working as a massage therapist for 2 years full time. And I was just going like, I just felt so like low motivation. Like I wanted something more. I wanted to be, you know, like I loved being an RNT for, you know, I continued doing it actually part-time on the side. And I loved doing it in terms of like caring for my clients and like being able to help people and the education that I got from it. But being indoors, like in that room all day long and like not being able to travel. And like, I wanted something more dynamic and just something with just more adventure, something that was just different, I guess. So it was super random. It wasn't by me knowing deep down that I was going to be a pilot. Like, you know how I'm sure some of your guests have said this before, or like maybe yourself too. Like, you know, you're a kid, you're like, I know, I'm convinced this is what's going to be, you know, for me. But for myself, it just happened accidentally. My dad randomly suggested it to me. Like he knew I was like seeking something else. Like he knew I was like brainstorming and trying to figure out like another step in my life or another chapter. Mm-hmm. And he just randomly suggested it after meeting someone who was a pilot. It was a woman too. And I guess he must have seen some similarities with, you know, it was like his client's daughter, right? Like they just went for dinner or something. And he's like, oh, I met, you know, this person and she was a pilot. And have you ever thought about that? And I just, you know, I kind of stood there and I was like, no, I've never considered it. But now that you have, it was like, you know, Inception, right? Like that movie, it was right, like, right. Just, I couldn't like let it go. I was almost like, it was like, it just really, you know, it was really something that was exciting all of a sudden. I was like, oh, wow. Like thought about different possibilities. So did a bit of research and I just went for an intro flight and that was like 10 years ago and here I am now. So it happened so organically from that point onwards. It was really nice that I became so passionate for it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Did you have an interest in any other gear like cars or motorcycles before that? Anything that was sort of that might have made your dad think, well, she likes, you know, sports cars.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know if this is related, but like I've always enjoyed driving. Like I drive standard, like I do really involve myself like in the activity. And I've always been like, I'm obsessed with travel. Now my dad, there's a nice big map behind me there mm-hmm. with all our pins of where we've been. But so like he knew that aspect. He knew I loved the travel. And whenever my parents would go on trip, because they were both businessman and women, my dad would always bring back postcards and they would always like just instill that like wonder and that like awe, like that wanderlust of just like wanting to explore more. And I think them taking us on lots of family vacations when we were young too, they just, you know, my dad saw kind of like the opportunity and saw, yeah, you're capable of doing something like this. Like, I, you know, he believed in me in that sense and he just suggested it. I guess he would just put two and two together.
Oh, fantastic. So there was no childhood hero that you wanted to emulate?
No. No one in my family is in the industry. Like I didn't have anybody, you know, I know a lot of people like their father or like an aunt or uncle or someone else in the family has been a pilot. So they've been able to look up to that or witnessed it, but I didn't have any of that. It was super random. Now I do have a younger cousin who's doing his flight training, which is kind of neat. So it's kind of nice to have not just myself as the only aviator in the family, but it, completely out of nowhere. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Were there things that were, I mean, especially because you didn't come from having it in your sort of tribal history. So were there things that were really unexpected for you on the journey to become an airline pilot?
I mean, how much time do you have?
Well, the highlights perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, I think like, I think that the biggest thing that I remember surprising me was I just figured I would just like the flying. I was like, you know what? Okay, the intro flight was so cool. Like I enjoyed it so much. I figured, you know, I'm going to enjoy that aspect so much more than kind of everything else, this, you know, the other studies. But I think that's the part that surprised me is how much I actually did enjoy that entire world. Cause you know, aviation is like a different beast and a different world in itself. So I think it was like the aeronautics, like maybe not air law, maybe we'll skip that one, but like even surprisingly, like the meteorology behind it, like mm-hmm. just all the aspects of, you know, getting involved in aviation intrigued me so much more. So it, like, it was kind of easier, you know, we know the studies are challenging and we know there's a lot to review and there's so much stuff to learn, but it made it just a little bit less daunting because I was so interested in it.
Well, on a really sort of topical note, as a woman, were there, you think, challenges that you faced specifically on that journey because you were a woman that you would like to see change perhaps and to share with potential other young women that are interested in pursuing the career?
Yeah, it's for sure. There's any time that you're, you know, not the majority of people, let's call it, you know, a minority in a sense. Anytime that you're the minority, there's going to be some extra challenges for sure. And I think the one that I kind of struggled with is maybe not having like a mentor of sorts, like someone that I could actually, because I did have, you know, male mentors, but in terms of also having someone that I could, you know, go to and talk to about the specific issues that I might've been going through. I think that was something that, you know, one of the reasons why I started like my Instagram and I started to try to connect with people is to try to be that role model down the road that I kind of never had as a woman, right? Because there weren't that many. It's still, I mean, you know, the numbers, it's still what, 7 to 10%, or maybe I think it's less, 5 to 7% of women, depending on, you know, if you go worldwide or, you know, Canada or whatnot. But I think that's just having someone that you could go to bounce ideas off of, or to like share your struggles specifically when, you know, when you're the only woman in the room, like that is different. That is a different experience than, you know, maybe what a man might go through. So that's definitely something that I experienced. In terms of it stopping me, obviously, you know, I was able to kind of push through and continue, but I do see it as a deterrent for other women who maybe they're not as outspoken, or maybe they're a bit shy, or maybe like they need to continue improving their confidence. So if you don't have someone else that you can kind of fall back on, it's very intimidating, like, you know, to enter the room and you're the only woman around. So hopefully that, you know, starts to change a little bit, and there's more support out there for more young ladies getting into this.
Absolutely. Are there chapters of the 99s in Canada? I know there's an international 99s, and of course they're famous down here.
There's not as much activity depending on like where you are. So some of them are a bit more like dormant, we'll call them. So it is a resource for sure. There's no doubt. And especially now with social media and like Facebook groups, there's like tons of access. There's a lot more access than 10 years ago. But it's definitely an option for women to reach out to that for their, you know, flying sisters or however you want to call it.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a paradox when it comes to these communities, people that are not in the majority within the aviation community, as you put it very well. When I was learning to fly in my teens, there were two women that played a very pivotal role in my flying education. One of whom was a woman about your age in the general vicinity of it. And then there was another who was whom I really associated the typical woman in aviation at that time, because I actually was aware of a population. They were 99s. Okay. And she was actually, I think, one of the founding members of the LA chapter. But she was a woman in, I think, her 70s or 80s who was still flying. Mm-hmm. And she did cross-country air racing. And she actually taught me to do some cross-country air racing. And the first flight we took, she cranked her Cessna 182 over to 90 degrees of bank as we crossed the shoreline departing Santa Monica. And as I looked over at her, I thought she'd be clutching her chest, having a heart attack. But she, with her red, these are not pigtails, what are they, braids?
Yeah, sure.
She was a little old grandma with red hair, like Pippi Longstockings, and with her red braids, she was laughing and giggling at the fun she was having.
Yeah.
And I mean, mind was blown. She was a sweet, wonderful person. Definitely made an impression on me and helped mentor me. And my other instructor was also very, very good. And it's one of the reasons why I want to do focus shows like this, so that we make it clear to the little people, young people. I don't mean like little, like she was like 5 feet tall. But the young people today, that there are people that look like them who are grown-ups that are doing Absolutely. It and that they can do this too. But the 99s, like a lot of people in aviation, were at the in that era were mostly much older folks that were doing air racing in a sort of an enclave community where today, like you point out on social media, I mean, if you looked at social media in terms of the popular Instagram accounts, you would think that there's mostly women in aviation.
Yes.
It's right?
What you were saying earlier with like the, it's almost like an oxymoron, or it's like the irony of the whole thing. Yeah.
But there are a lot of dudes obviously on Instagram as well. Some of them are very fashion focused as pilots as well, with enormous followings. It's like everything. The description of our community is not one that is simple and easy to say succinctly, because we are a diverse bunch, although the ratios are not exactly proportional. Mm-hmm. And they're getting better, but they got a long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, let me see here. The milestones to get you from dad, yeah, I kind of hear what you're saying, to four stripes. I mean, yes. we're not gonna take an entire show about this, but if you could just, again, for those young people, what did it look like? Because you've done it in 10 years. That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's funny because for some people, 10 years is so short. Like, you know, like if you're comparing, you know, other people's careers, and it's crazy to think, yet when you're experiencing it, it feels like forever, right? Like 10 years seems like it's a long time. So, especially when you're doing like a career change as well, like when it's further down in your age or your lifetime. But in terms of like the story or like the milestones that you're mentioning, because I had already had post-secondary education, I chose to kind of do it, you know, not through like, we call them integrated programs. I think the US has a different name for it, like when it's all like pre-planned for you. I'm not sure what you guys call that.
Okay.
But
it's like a scripted, like syllabus where you go from here to here. And it's,
Like, so mine was way more like a mom and pop type of flying environment. So I could just kind of cater my schedule to however I needed it to be, because I was still working full time as a massage therapist. So I kind of just started my lessons. But one of the things that I did, and I've mentioned this before on other podcasts, that I felt was really, really important, was that I didn't just like start right away. I also just took a look at the structure, or like, maybe this is me being the organized person that I am, but like I wanted to set myself like the overarching timeline of what it would look like, because I wanted to be able to like work incrementally towards that goal, because I didn't want it to just be kind of all over the place and not have consistency, or not have like that, you know, consistency, I guess is a good word, but I wanted to make sure that I was going to go about it in like a smarter or a smart enough way. So I made sure that I like had a chat with my instructor, and I asked him, I was like, listen, like what's realistic for me? Like what, you know, how many years is this going to take me? What do I need to do to achieve this? So my goal in my mind was like, I'm going to finish all my licenses by 25, because I started when I was just about to turn 23, I think, or just after 23. So I was like, okay, I want to try to do this within like 3 years. Like what do I need to do to commit to this? And I think that's really, really important, because a lot of people get into this not knowing the involvement that's going to be, you know, that you're going to be committing to. Yeah. So I did that, and it was really important, because it made me want to achieve those goals. So on a daily basis, like when I didn't want to wake up at 5 a.m, I could look to that and be like, well, I still want to achieve that goal. So that was like the first big milestone, I guess you could say, is, you know, getting my private license, getting my commercial, my multi IFR is what we call it here, for twin engine, with your IFR, your instrument flight rule rating. Mm. So I got all that. And then I also got my instructor rating, because at the time, the industry just obviously wasn't the way it was, you know, pre-COVID, we'll call it. But I had to work obviously as an instructor before, you know, doing that next step. So I got all of those in about 3 years, just like punching it out basically. And then, I don't know, afterwards, I guess, you know, we could talk about, you know, my instructing or when I went to the next step or whatnot. But I think that going back to kind of what I was mentioning in terms of like that structure, I think that's really important, because I think a lot of people get into this without that guidance if you're not doing a program that's preset for you. So I think that giving yourself that discipline, or like to have those goals, I think was monumental in like the success that I got with it.
So when you had gotten the commercial, did you look for work to just build hours doing banner toe or anything like that?
I applied to a bunch of places, and you know, at the time it was like, you know, you could consider going up, you know, north. We call it going up north in Canada. I don't know if you guys have a similar expression in the States, but sure. Going up north to like smaller operators and, you know, looking to see if you could do like dispatching or something else to like get your shoe into the company. And even still, this would have been in end of 2012, going on 2013, yeah. And there wasn't the same movement that ended up coming afterwards. So that's why I decided, I didn't want to become an instructor at first, but that's why I decided to become a flight instructor afterwards.
Well, at least, I worked for a flight school as a line boy to pay for my flying lessons. Mm. And quite a few of the people that went up through the chain definitely did their commercial, their instructors, and were biding their time, either yep. trying to jump to business jets or to at least the regionals in those days, so they could you know, hopefully get an opportunity to fly the heavy iron. Mm. So you basically, very similar though, you then built your hours, you know, in instructing and yep. instructing and things like that. Yep. And then it was resumes and adding yes. some additional.
Yeah. So when I hit like at the time, again, in Canada, when you're getting closer to like 1,000 hours was when you could start to look to like, you know, the next step. So I did teach for about 3.5 years, you know, before looking to like the next chapter of my aviation career. So it you know, you put in a bit of time, right, when you're teaching. So I was really happy actually once I did start teaching as well. I really ended up enjoying it a lot more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I don't have my commercial, sadly. Although I had taken the written for it when I was 18, but nice. I didn't have the hours to actually get it, and so that all expired. But the idea, I'm 6'2" tall, and the idea of spending hours and hours and hours folded in half in a 152, you know, instructing just did not seem like it would be comfortable for me.
Yeah.
I actually have to go get current. I got my flight review is due, and I'm going to add a commercial drone pilot's license to my ticket. So I am going to probably get a 172 at least, so I'm not folded entirely in half.
A little bit more space, yeah.
Yeah, to get in there. So there's a subtle hint of adventure, both in what you said earlier. I think it's actually listed on your bio, and and what we've seen on your account. And you know, for most of us, visiting Africa, let alone flying there, would be an incredible adventure. But you didn't only go to Africa or fly to Africa. You flew as a pilot working in Africa. Where and when did this take place?
So, so the appeal was there, like the adventure right off the bat, right? Like you mentioned it. I was like, I want to do something different. I didn't necessarily want to... I was like, you know, I didn't even know if I was going to go to the airlines either. Like it wasn't like the original goal when I got into aviation. So I was like, why don't I just expose myself to different things and different types of flying? So this came up as an opportunity, and I ended up, this was in 2017. So I had done all my training, of course, with the company that I was starting with, and it is a Canadian company. So a lot of people ask me like, oh, did you have to convert your licenses or anything like that? But again, because I have my Canadian, you know, airline or ATPL, and it was a, you know, no conversion for that. So that was in 2017, and I did my PPC on the Dash 8 in Canada, and then I just flew out. I think it was in September is when I left, and I was based out of the DRC, so the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I was involved with a company that does UN missions, so humanitarian work. Some of them is like the World Food Program, if you're familiar with it. So there's different like branches of the UN. So depending on where you were based out of, you had the different missions that you were associated with. So ours was more humanitarian, peacekeeping type of mission. So lived out there, and it's a 2-month rotation at a time. So you would do, you know, 2 months on and then 2 months back off, you know, when you would come back to wherever you wanted to go live, because you're just working, you know, 6 months out of the year, really. It was an amazing, amazing experience. I wish I could have stayed longer, because I ended up not being able to go back, unfortunately. So it was cut a little bit shorter than I anticipated, unfortunately. But it definitely changed me, not only as a pilot in terms of growth, but it changed me as a human being as well, because it just, the lessons that you learn and like the stuff that you see and the adventures that you get in an environment like that, it's I'm really grateful. I'm really, really grateful for my time there.
I can only imagine. For people that are not geography majors or that familiar, the Democratic Republic of Congo is essentially in the heart of Africa almost. Yes. I mean, it's really sort of maybe more to the right side of the chest than the left, but it's in the central Africa, slightly to the right, but no coastal exposure at all. So you're in the jungle there, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. So oddly enough, the DRC does have a coast.
Oh, does
like
it?
Not wrong. Like it's okay. Like tiny, tiny. So Kinshasa, the capital city, is very, very west. If you look at how, but you said it right. I mean, it's really the heart of Africa. But Kinshasa, all the way to the west side of it, even further west, has a coastal aspect. Whereas, like where we were, it was definitely in the most eastern portion of the country. Actually bordering Rwanda, and then Burundi is close beneath it there too. So very much in the center of Africa.
Well, thank you for being so polite about my mistake. you were flying the Dash 8 there as well.
Yeah. So the Dash 8 checked out on the 300, 100, that one that we had in Bukavu, which was the city that I was based out of in the DRC. It was a 100 variant. So no APU in the middle of Africa was just, wow. Yeah, you can imagine.
Wow. Wow. That's all I got. And I'm guessing GPUs were not readily available.
I mean, they're available, but you start to know which ones you want. Like we would go on, one of the places that we went to was Entebbe in Uganda. And like we would show up there, and Entebbe is like a very, it's an international airport. So lots of stuff, but you would know which GPU you'd want. You'd be like, no, we don't want number 10. We don't want number 8. We want 7 and 9, like because of the voltage, you start to pick it out so well.
Oh, wow. Because yeah. it would over or under volt your system?
Yeah, just the consistency. Sometimes you're like, oh, yeah. Oh,
okay. And just to be clear, I threw out GPU as an acronym, but it's ground power unit versus APU, which is auxiliary power unit, so that you can do things like run your air conditioning if you've got it, and electronics and stuff, so that
exactly
the machine's alive and not baking, presumably. Yes. Exactly. In the heart of Africa.
Exactly.
Were there any health challenges while you were there that you would care to share?
Yes. Did you read my throwback stories?
I tried to do some preparation for the interview, but it's a natural question for anybody who's a traveler. And I'm not talking about tourism here. I'm talking about traveling. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to go outside your comfort zone, outside your bubble, and you're going to go to exotic places and do things like eat street food, which I'm a little bit less brave about than perhaps I ought to be. But I also like to spend my time, you know, upright when I'm in a distant location and not over a toilet. So it's a reasonable question to ask if you're comfortable talking about it.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I have no, I'm very honest with this kind of stuff. I'm like, come on, this is the reality. Like, let's be real. Right. But, there is an expression actually down there called the African guts. If you never get sick off eating, it's nothing to do with the food specifically. It's the bacteria that your gut is just not used to, right? Absolutely. So that was the biggest challenge. And I was very much warned about this, and I did my best. You know, unfortunately, we couldn't drink the water that comes out of the tap, right? So we had to have bottled water. So I think, I don't know how it happened, but I suspect that I accidentally brushed my teeth with the tap water, like just not even thinking, like right early, you know, first, I think like maybe the second week that I was there. And I have never been that sick, like in terms of like gut like issues. It was violent. It was violent for sure. It just, your gut, your flora, your inner gut flora is just, what is this? This is so foreign, like, you know, super uncomfortable. Yeah.
Out, everybody.
Going
out.
That way, yeah. So I was really lucky, obviously, that, you know, the other people that you're on rotations with, you know, a lot of them in my situation, they had all been there before. So this wasn't their first rotation, right?
Right.
So, you know, I just texted my captain right away and I was like, I'm not coming to work. And unfortunately, the challenge with working in that environment is you're the only crew. Mm-hmm. So there's this feeling of like guilt pressure. Almost because yeah. and pressure because you're like, I feel garbage. Like I can't operate an aircraft, obviously, but I know that right now the flights aren't being completed because I'm vertical or horizontal, I should say. So I ended up actually having to be taken to the clinic, the UN clinic, because I got so dehydrated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could like hardly stand up because I was so dizzy. But thankfully, like I said, my captain was like, no, we're going to the clinic, like got our drivers, went to the clinic. And I'm not sure if you've ever had the pleasure of drinking dehydration salts.
No.
An experience.
Not like a margarita, I'm guessing, or maybe
Oh my goodness.
Okay, that's shocking.
Yeah, so I had to get dehydration salts because your body is just so depleted of all nutrients at that point. And right. I was able to get better after a couple of days, but it made me even more cautious of washing our food. Like we had to wash our food with like vinegar to try to remove like some of the bacteria that was on it. So I was very careful after that.
Well, that has not happened to me, but I was a line producer on a small nonprofit fundraising film that we shot in the former Soviet Union. Mm. And in this particular country we were in, we were warned, and I was like a border collie dog, like herding, my crew. No, don't eat those fresh vegetables. No, don't, only bottled water. No ice cubes. And it was a total paranoia for the weeks that we were there. I'm sorry.
It probably served you right because it's pretty impactful how much it makes a difference for your gut. And I'm sure that like a lot of people start to get a bit more used to it, right, in terms of like the vegetables and maybe the water, you probably have to continuously avoid it, but for someone who was so fresh like myself, like I was like, no.
I mean, we think of Americans as being sort of undiluted when it comes to their international exposure, but you look like about as fresh-faced a kid as there could possibly be. He's like, hi, Africa, I'm here.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
What, got a snack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. But I wonder if things like probiotics, acidophilus and stuff like that could help protect the gut, but that's a whole, probably another show.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I am quite big on those kind of supplements and making sure that I get
what I pretty eat. Healthy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I actually even brought I brought all fish oil supplements with me. Like I brought a bunch of stuff with me, but I don't think that probiotics would be, would help prevent something like this because it's so different. Like the locals have no issue whatsoever, right? Like it's just as if they came here and they were all of a sudden exposed to all our gross pesticides and whatever we put on our foods, right? It would be the same thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is, it's an alternate universe or time shifted for all intents and purposes for the gut. And what the gut don't want, the gut don't want.
No.
What was navigation like there? Putting back your four bars on your shoulder here.
Yeah.
GPS obviously knows no boundaries except when people are jamming it. But I'm guessing procedures and even things like maps and visual landmarks and stuff like that. Walk me through how that was different than Canada.
Yeah, it's very different. Do you guys have a lot of, I think in the States, you guys don't have as much as this, but do you guys have a lot of airports where there's just a mandatory frequency or even sometimes there is no frequency and there's aircraft kind of flying around with like no radio? Like, I feel like in the States, there's less of that. Do you guys have that?
Yeah, well, we have uncontrolled airports. Santa Paula, which is one that you may be familiar with, has got a lot of wonderful Instagrammers and a lot of experimental community members hang out there. That's uncontrolled, but people do get on the common frequency and broadcast their intentions.
Right.
There are certain areas in certain airspace where you can fly. Others you can't penetrate without a waiver, without having a two-way radio. Of course, there are the protests about people saying that using a two-way radio is an infringement of their rights. You can't impose.
Exactly. That's a whole other story. Yeah.
Exactly. But so, yeah, that's.
There was twofold, I guess. Okay, I guess because in Canada, it's quite common to have airports that have no, there's a mandatory frequency. So you, in those cases, you would have to have a radio and you would have to, you know, advise all the other traffic and coordinate yourself with the other traffic. So that aspect was definitely present in certain airports that we went to. So there was the, you know, they're uncontrolled. A lot of the airports were uncontrolled. So you're just reporting, making those, you know, specific position reports. The challenge was the fact that it was a non-radar environment. So that was the big challenge. So, you know, when you're at the airport itself, you can generally coordinate yourself with other aircraft. Sometimes there were certain airports where, although it was just that frequency and you had someone actually supervising that frequency, they tend to give clearances, even though it was an uncontrolled airport. So it was a really interesting, you know, environment to navigate, because at the back of your mind, like, you're fully aware that this is not a clearance, but, you know, you had to navigate that. So that was really interesting.
Somebody wants to be a controller, even though they're not a controller.
It's just the mindset difference. It wasn't necessarily even like wanting that. It was more of like, they would shoulder the responsibility, even though it wasn't like required of them, if that makes sense. It was really interesting to do, you know, to navigate that. And the other aspect, like I mentioned, was the fact that it was non-radar. So that made for even more interesting conflicts in terms of where people are reporting and, you know, where you are in space and time and like your situational awareness and where other traffic is. So it was literally just like old school way, like when you're reporting, when you're, you know, not talking about airports, when we're just talking about like en route environment where there are controllers, but they don't have radar. So they don't actually have an actual live feedback of where you are. It's us making position reports over waypoints, just like how you might do that in Canada or in the US, but they're physically moving, you know, your dot around so that they have an idea of where you are. Now, of course, the challenge with this is whether or not you're saying the truth, right? So because there would be, you know, different nationalities, different levels of airmanship that you have to interact with, that, you know, certain people would just be like, you know what, we're ahead of you. And so you would think from a controller perspective, well, you're ahead of you, you're going to get that clearance to shoot an approach first. But of course, that's not always the case in terms of where that person physically is, right? So there were numerous times where we would say be ahead in terms of who would get the clearance next, but the aircraft would have reported ahead of you, so you had to wait in line. So yeah, very, very interesting, not full-on conflicts, but some frustrations for sure, you know, if it was repeated or whatnot. So that was really interesting.
So it was the flow of instrument traffic in addition to, were you implying separation sometimes in the airport environment?
Yeah, because, or even approaching the airport. Because once you got to the airport, now you were handed off to just the fact that it was like that mandatory frequency. So you were responsible for your own, you know, separation and getting, you know, your clearance, you know, telling yourself that you can go and land. But in terms of us being in an IFR environment where you don't actually have that separation, or you can't see the traffic, or you can't prevent that conflict, when you're reporting and you're not necessarily saying where you are, that starts to get, you know, the safety aspect there, it definitely starts to get affected, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with no radar, your safe separation depends entirely on the accuracy of those reports.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the airport traffic area for a lightweight like me, I mean, it's important if you say you're downwind a beam to be downwind a beam, or at least down here amongst your downstairs neighbors, Canada, our controllers will scold you. If you're not there, you will get yelled at. Camarillo Airport, I'm looking at you. They've got a grouchy controller over there. Yes. And not yelled at me, but I've been in aircraft where they've been, and no TV three nights.
Yeah.
Very strict enforcement. But yeah, so that position, like at Santa Monica, though, we always called up, like over Malibu when we were inbound with the ATIS to just ask permission to enter the airport traffic area in those days. But you know, if you fudge that, they were thinking situationally about where other traffic was to help you avoid running into each other as everybody's heading for the downwind in a place like Africa. If you've got big aircraft and oh my gosh,
And it's not even just that separation. It's also like the IMC factor, right? Like it's one thing if it's pure, you know, I don't care if it's VMC, it's visual, right? And yeah, I can see you. That's no problem. Like, if you're going to say that you're over here, but you're actually over here, but I can see you, like, you know, it's less of a concern. We'll call it that. But then all of a sudden your IMC, that is just, yeah, it's the wild, wild west, you know, of flying. There's no doubt about it. Yeah.
It is a terrestrial equivalent to what's going on the oceanic routing, which when it works is what allows the really close separation and some really great videos. I don't know if you've seen these where, you know, somebody's in the cockpit and they've got somebody passing them this way, yet another aircraft comes and splits in the other direction.
Amazing.
I know what they're supposed to be doing, but it still terrifies me. I don't know about you, but those are the crazy crossing enclosure shots. But yeah, over land, not so good. What about fuel access and the quality? Was there ever any issue getting stuff that would keep PT6s or Alec Garrett's, or what was on your dash? PT6s.
Oh my God, I can't. Yeah, I think they're PT6s on that one too, on the 100 as well. So it's actually really funny that you bring that up. I actually haven't been asked that, but it is something that we actually had to oversee every single day. Yeah, no problem. But it's actually something that I was responsible for actually as a first officer. And normally, you know, in terms of, you know, like when we're dealing with the fuel, like, you know, you get your fuel slip from the handler, like in the airline environment that I'm dealing with, like you get the fuel slip, that, you know, the quality assurance aspect, you have nothing to do with, right? Like that's the supplier and you don't really touch that. You just look at the quantity. But for us actually down there, we actually had to have them test the fuel every single time in front of us. So they would test it, they would show us, you know, like in water content or lack thereof more so. They would like, I forget what they used though. This is kind of racking my brain. They used a dye of sorts and I forget what it was to do, but it was, I think it had to do with the quality of it? I forget off the top of my head, but they did have to show us, they like put a dye in it to make sure like that it was not only no water obviously in it, but the quality of it was like a certain standard. So I forget what it was and we had to kind of sign off on it to show and to confirm that we witnessed, you know, them testing it in front of us, because I didn't experience this myself, obviously, but in terms of, you know, rebel activity, that's definitely, you know, an easy target, you know, for an aircraft flying, you know, UN personnel to affect it. So we definitely have to oversee that.
Sure, sure. I mean, one of the things that I want the audience to understand is that I don't, I'm asking these questions because the environment here is the frontier, essentially. It's not meant to be specific to like Africa or a country in Africa. This is just the reality of being in a place that is a frontier. It's not, the infrastructure isn't as developed. It's a developing country or an undeveloped country is probably the way it's been categorized. And if you're going to go off and do these adventures, whether it's, you know, exploring the Arctic or the Antarctic or something like that, these key resources are critical. And you don't have a choice but to make sure that everything that goes into your aircraft is safe and is working properly. And in places like this, it's hard to get really good things from the source of production all the way to your tank.
Yeah.
And
it's not something like sometimes I think it's really good that you're actually bringing this up, and it's a good point of discussion, because I think it actually, if anything, it highlights the need for improvement in those areas too, right? Because we know that, you know, say the fuel or like the, you know, the amenities that we're dealing with, like it would be amazing if we could have those, you know, improve. So it's just, it gives perspective to people to realize like, yeah, this level of luxury that you might have in your airport, like this is not the reality for numerous people around the world. So if anything, it highlights that need, and maybe people know this already, I don't know, but it kind of confirms like, you know, not, you know, you have a privilege, like where you are right now and your flight training and that environment, like, you know, count your blessings really, because that not everybody gets to experience that. So I think it's important.
Oh, well, I appreciate you saying that. Speaking of infrastructure and quality, what were the conditions at the airports like? I know you actually left the country and you flew to Uganda and went to Entebbe, but in say the DRC, taxiways, runways, things like that. I mean, here in the States, I've landed at airports that have potholes in them and really sketchy conditions. So I just imagine that if you were using the typical blacktop style, not asphalt concrete, but the heat alone would damage those. And the heavy, there's heavy downpours there too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's definitely differences in, you know, what you're dealing with. So, Entebbe, you know, as the example that you mentioned, you know, paved runways and full ILSs, full controlled environment, full radar there. Right. But whereas, you know, if any of the followers, anybody listening looks up Beni Airport in the DRC, you know, dirt strip and, you know, like the airport is, you know, a shack on the side of the runway, like that dirt wow. strip, right? So it's, you know, the security is, you know, one gentleman sitting at the edge of the door to let you through, right? So it's very, very different. And you just have to kind of roll with it. You just gotta just take it for this is what it is. And you can't complain about it, because this is the reality. This is the, you know, in certain cases, this is the best that they've got, that they're doing their absolute best, right? Yeah. So there's an expression there, and you might've heard this in movies, it's called TIA. This is Africa. You might've heard that. I think in Blood Diamond, I think they mentioned it, but that's the expression that you would go to, right? Like, this is Africa. Like this is the environment that you're dealing with. So you definitely grow a bit of a thicker skin for certain things to bother you. Like, you know, I would look back and like I would fly with, you know, certain captains sometimes, and they'd be upset that the ground crew wasn't on time or whatnot. And I'm like, yeah, this is fine. This is still fine.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, did you ever land on grass, or was it always?
No, there it was only, they had all just dirt strips. And then I think Beni was part gravel, or one of them was gravel. Part of it was gravel. I don't think it was like half and half. I think we could actually take off in the dirt portion. No grass, no.
Well, de Havilland has a small history of making go anywhere, do anything flying machines. It sounds like your Dash 8 actually was really well qualified
for the job. Yeah. Oh yeah. And it was the 100 too. So in terms of just that, you know, although it was like, you know, it's not the Q400 in terms of, you know, horsepower that we've got going on, right? So the terrain clearance maybe wasn't as ideal, but in terms of the takeoff and landing performance was quite nice for the 100 for sure.
And your props being up on the top of that wing, Kate, stayed well away from things like bits of gravel, I would imagine, stuff like that. So yeah, sure. That was probably helpful. I would be a little bit nervous thinking about dirt landings with that gear, especially the mains, just feeling like they might be roughed up a bit by that. But
any landing in the Dash 8 is just... it's just not going to be nice. Yeah.
Oh, Joe. Okay. But I mean, it wasn't, did you suffer gear damage or excessive wear and tear just from being off airport?
That's in terms of the gear itself. No, but I do know that they replaced, the tires more frequently than say like your average operator. So that was definitely a component. And it was actually really cool to see the maintenance aspect of things. That's another thing that a lot of people like aren't aware of when you're in this environment, is that, you know, everything, like our maintenance engineers that we have there would work on an aircraft, you know, on opposite shifts as us. So we would go in the day, you know, do our flights, and then they would come over in the afternoon and do whatever, you know, maintenance that needed to be done. But they had access to everything. So like almost everything was with, you know, a bunker, and they had access to it so that they could go back. And so it was really neat, because, you know, so many of us are used to thinking about maintenance like a separate kind of a separate entity.
And very antiseptic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So whereas us, it's like we were so involved. It was very much like a day-to-day interaction, you know, like notice the oxygen tank's a bit low, like just, so it was constantly like that back and forth. But all of the extra tires, like all of anything that you can think of that our maintenance engineers needed was right there with us, which was really cool.
Do you think they were standard tires, or is there even an availability for something that might be a little softer and bigger? I know they have to go get stowed, so maybe that's not even an option on the Dash 8, but there are other aircraft that can, you know, do off-airport.
Yeah. That's a more of a technical question. I wouldn't actually know whether or not it was different for us down there, but...
Nothing you noticed.
Was that, sorry?
No, sorry, nothing you noticed.
No.
Yeah. How about the weather and the briefings? We talked a bit about the IMC issues and separation, but And I think I hinted on the fact that I'm sure that there was a lot of heat and also tropical downpours, right? So what was it like, A, getting good briefings, and B, flying in the weather?
Yeah, so good question, because it was something that I hadn't experienced yet. So it was kind of twofold. So I was there during the rainy season. So of course, being near the equator, it's, you know, it's not seasons anymore. It's just the rainy or the dry seasons, right? So we were there during the rainy season. So I quickly learned that there is torrential downpour about once a day, right? So you just expect it. And that heat was, just next level, no doubt about it. I was in September. I was in September too, to give you perspective. So that was, you know. And if anybody knows anything about the Dash 8, the air system and the air conditioning is very finicky. So you'd be dealing with, 35 plus degrees on the ground in Uganda, just like just sweat, like, right? This is just the reality, right? You're just sweating.
Sure.
And then you get to 25,000 and just freezing cold, right? Because there's just no balance with that aircraft. So that was interesting. But in terms of weather, I quickly learned that, in terms of what we're used to in like North America, or even you guys, in the States, we're dealing with frontal weather. Right. So we can study it. We know what to expect. We can see that front moving, especially, we get used to the patterns. The challenge with flying near the equator is that you don't really have those fronts anymore. Right. So all the weather systems that you're dealing with is all pop-up thunderstorms from daytime heating. So once you're in IMC with, if you've got some basic background knowledge of weather systems, they pick up moisture, right? So like it basically shoots a beam ahead, and it gets a return in terms of how much moisture is ahead of you. So the challenge with being an IMC and not dealing with frontal weather is that you don't get to know where those other thunderstorm cells are. So very, very challenging environment in terms of once you are IMC to be able to figure out, okay, what am I getting myself into? And we all know how dangerous, thunderstorms are, and in the hail aspect of it too, and being in the downdraft. So we avoided as much as possible. So it was lots of weaving through and around the cells, because once you were IMC, it was just too challenging to be able to see. The weather radar cannot give you that worse return ahead. Yeah, so that was really interesting.
You're basically lost in a cotton ball until you manage to break out the other side.
Yeah, well, because it gives you that return. You do know that you're surrounded by moisture, which makes sense. You can see it outside, but in terms of worsening cells that you really want to be avoiding,
you can't
tell it as much, right? Whereas if you're outside, if you're VMC and there's a really thick cell ahead, no problem. Your weather radar will pick that up individually. So a lot of weaving, but it made it challenging once you were IMC. Now keep in mind, again, with the non-radar environment now plus these cells, it was really challenging to give position reports, because normally a waypoint is nice and easy. You can be like right over, but now all of a sudden you're off that waypoint. You have to give this non-radar environment your position report. I'm 20 miles east of so-and-so waypoint, trying to deal with the cells. So yes, it was an extra challenge. It was really neat to fly in that environment.
Wow, that was and you're doing it in a sort of a quasi-modern way, in the sense that your aircraft is certainly more modern than a DC-3 would have been 15, 20 years ago. And all of the support systems and satellite information that might have been available. But were you able to do things like capture a quick update via satellite? Was your aircraft equipped with? No, okay.
No, unfortunately. So. No, we had terrain, terrain system and terrain awareness. And we had the weather system, the weather radar, which was great. And, GPS, of course. So we had all of those, separate systems. But in terms of getting it, a snapshot of the weather update, no. So you really have to deal with what you're looking at.
And that sounds like it was flowing also into the briefings, because the briefing would be about as useless as the weather radar in the middle of it. It's going to change. It's going to be dependent upon the evolution of the heat and the moisture at that time on that particular day.
Yeah. And I mean, you still, there's still days where you could see, we did still have weather updates and weather reports and briefings, for the start of the day or through the afternoon. So we would still go to we had weather offices at the different airports, depending on, where we were landing or if we had more time to look at it. So the briefings did vary. You know, certain days you could tell there was going to be worse storms or worse weather, or, you know, we knew we were going to be having to shoot down an ILS, you know, down to minimums or whatever the case may be. But you have to keep it in mind. Again, it's almost like TIA applies here as well. It's like you just have to deal with what you're seeing, because it changes so much.
Wow. Wow. Did you ever have any of the the fauna do any hitchhiking on your aircraft, like snakes on a plane?
No. Oh my God. If only. No, we didn't. I was like almost wanting this to happen, because I'd heard numerous stories of cow crossings, like right, like on the runways, right? Because like a lot of them are obviously dirt strips, and this is unfortunate, but numerous of the runways had been built in areas where different, you know, communities of people have to cross, you know, to get to like the different other communities that are close nearby, or to like grocery stores or whatever the case. So there is a path of people that was naturally there. And sometimes it's people, sometimes it can be cattle or you know, whatever the case may be. But it's unfortunate that those airports were built there, because those patterns were already established before those airports might have been, right? So I was like, I almost wanted one of them. I'm like, I just want to witness one time that we have to do an overshoot because there's like cows or something on the runway. I was like, if it's going to happen, it's going to be here. But I didn't witness it, unfortunately.
Notum, giraffes crossing.
Yeah.
East End.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, before I forget, when you talked about the dodging the thunderstorms, yeah. It makes me imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that when you were flying on those days with that kind of weather, the view you must have had, though, must have been absolutely epic if you were flying in canyons between towering cumulus over Africa.
It was, yes. And I did post, if you go back to my Instagram, I did post a couple pictures, and I'm actually coming up with a video. I'm editing one right now for the issue with Premiere Pro is coming from this, but coming up with a video to show like just these huge cells of thunderstorms that we would be by, because we'd be, like you said, like weaving through, and like I'm talking quick development, like as we're flying, you know, abeam it, or like, you know, still giving it enough distance, but you could see like the moisture just rising up like quickly, like very, very quickly.
Yeah. If you didn't know better, you would think it was time lapse, because it's evolving so quickly. The cloud is just doing that. If you don't live in an environment where there are those forces, heat and moisture, and I'm not telling you, I'm sharing with the audience, of course, you don't realize that that's actually a process that is very possible and happens every day.
Yep. Exactly. No, it was really, something like you don't necessarily get to experience, like you said, if you haven't flown in those environments, right? Yeah.
Nature is whacked.
Nature is metal. Yes.
I think you've already answered this. You'd go back if you had the opportunity.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I miss a lot of the, cause you know, we kind of talked about this at the beginning in terms of like, I think before we were recording, but like, you know, as pilots, like our industry is so, you know, it's so dictated. It's so precise. It's so, you know, consistent in terms of like, you know, like the clearances, the approaches, like it's so rigid, right? So like an aspect that I really appreciated about being down there was just like how fluid and just how different your day might be depending on, you know, the weather or like the, you know, the other traffic that you might be dealing with, right? So it was that aspect of like that extra little like piece of freedom almost that you kind of had was really, really nice. And I fully understand why we need to be as organized as we are, right? I do still appreciate that. Yeah, but there's an aspect of that freedom that was just, it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a community, you know, aviation is so not homogenized. We are so very much in our various cliques. I went to Oshkosh twice. Once I drove there at 16, and then again on assignment for Flight International. It's now called Flight Global. But within the EAA, you see just one slice of this. There are the sport aircraft people that do aerobatics and things of that nature, the pit specials, Kristen Eagles, and all the monoplanes now that fly with incredible performance. There are the antique preserving air people. There are the warbird people. Mm-hmm. There's just the straight old general aviation people, you know, that fly their Cessnas and Beechcrafts and all that sort of thing. And one of the other communities, there's the home builders. I used to fly a Long Easy. And the home builders is one of the communities that I was a part of. And I love those crazy mad scientists there. But there's a whole other community, and this goes to the Africa and that experience. And Canada's got an incredible history with this, and that's the outback flyers, people mm-hmm. that fly whether the bush, not as well, actually as the Australians call it, but and Africans call the bush, but in Canada and in Alaska, you know, they fly 180s with gigantic tires, and they fly them into basically like three pieces of gravel and a stick, and land, you know, and that's Tuesday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and they're bringing, I don't know, caribou meat out or salmon in or just somebody's mail. Or that's just going home. You know, it's really, really incredible flying. There's a wonderful YouTube channel, Outback something. I feel terrible because I would love to give them a plug, but they stopped producing new films. They put great music together, and they would put together these little meetings amongst pilots in the Pacific Northwest in particular. And they would come to a strip of river, and it's like, to me, who's used to flying off of concrete, you know, it looks like there's this much land and it's by a bend in a river, and it's sort of gravelly rocks, and they're coming in, dragging their tires on the water. I don't know if that's safe or not. I'm not endorsing it, but it looks fun.
Yes.
And then they're stopping, you know, rolling out like, I don't know, a few meters stopping, and they're pulling off to the side, and then their buddy comes in, and then the next buddy comes in, and the next buddy comes in. They jump out, make a fire, and they're having a barbecue and having a great time, and then they fly home off of nothing.
So, yeah, I know, it's amazing. It's amazing the variety, and like, you know, I like that you touched upon that in the sense of like, it's not for everybody, right? Like different people are going to have their different, you know, wishes and their different preferences, we'll call it, but yeah, it's like parts of the flying that I did, like it's not for everybody. There's no doubt about it, right? So it was cool to be able to have that little sense of, like I said, freedom and a little bit like different, like doing something a little bit different or a little bit non-standard that maybe not everybody's done before.
Do you have any desire to fly helicopters?
I love that.
Oh, okay.
But I just, you know, maybe I don't want to get in $100,000 more in debt, you know, in terms of a license, but I would love that.
Very hard to understand why you would want to do that. Yeah.
no fun at all whatsoever. No, I would love that. Absolutely.
Well, maybe you'll attend a helicopter expo when those things start happening again.
Yeah.
And there's some pretty crazy flying machines. There's actually a Whirly Girls is a helicopter female pilot organization that does wonderful work promoting women in aviation also. Helicopters are crazy. They're sort of a magic carpet ride that makes very little physical sense. I've worked at them a lot, but they are also somewhat quietly terrifying when you think about the mechanics and what's spinning around up there. Mm-hmm. Well, what does the future hold for you in terms of your aviation career?
Craig, that's a great question.
If I know the answer, please DM you.
Yes, okay. please. Someone let me know. It's tough. I think you're aware, but I'm obviously laid off right now, just like thousands of other pilots.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So just like thousands of other pilots, you know, around the world, unfortunately. So it's, and I was laid off just obviously due to COVID, of course, just due to the downturn in demand.
Just to be clear. Yeah. It was not for disciplinary purposes.
Yeah. No, just cause I wanted to. No.
Yeah. You didn't puke in the airplane, and they're like, that's it. There's the door.
So it's challenging. It's definitely something that I wrestle with, you know, almost daily in terms of like, what am I going to do? You know, when is the industry going to recover from this? You know, where, like, do I look elsewhere? Do I put this on pause? Like it's very overwhelming certain days, right? Because you've committed so much of your life to this. And it's almost challenging because I can't see myself doing something else. Like this was already that goal and that dream that I've achieved, so to speak. So then now it's like, well, this is what I want to do. So if anything, I'm grateful for that aspect. I'm grateful that it's confirmed to me that I do want to still, you know, do this. But in terms of what's next, it's we're gonna see in terms of, you know, what happens with recall with my airline. I was laid off originally from my captain position. So when recalls do happen, just due to the downsizing, you know, I'll probably have to go back to being a first officer for a little bit, right? So because it's not everybody's gonna be able to go back to their spots right away.
Absolutely.
So you'd have to first, you know, go to being a first officer, and then as it trickles from the top almost, as it sucks up from the top, I should be able to go back to my captain position. But we really don't know, you know, when that's gonna happen, or, you know, so many factors. We don't know if there's gonna be a second wave of COVID, or, you know, what you guys are currently struggling with in the States right now. And yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. So I've been trying to, you know, stay positive and trying to have these opportunities like this. Like, this is amazing fun for me to do, like, podcasts and share more and get more creative. So I've just been trying to enjoy that aspect of it in the meantime.
Well, I'm honored to have you on the show, of course. And I actually had been sort of asking, not with the personal conceit that it was, that what we're going through with the pause and the downsizing of the industry is short term, mm-hmm. As they have been historically. Aviation has gone through these layoffs and, you know, a furloughing of aircraft, if you will, for years. One of the first photographs I sold as a photographer was of airplanes parked at Mojave that mm-hmm. the airlines had gotten rid of a long time ago, back when we used to shoot on film. So this is not entirely new. Mm-hmm. I know it's unprecedented in its scale, but I was sort of asking, based on, you know, if things resume and you continue to progress in a career, what were you trying to set as your own personal waypoints? Maybe asking it as, what's on your bucket list professionally? Aircraft to fly or career goals? Do you want to fly big iron? Do you want to fly whatever is out there, maybe replacing the 747, or maybe there'll still be someone's?
Yeah. Like, it's tough, because I, like, the realist part of me is, like, kicking in sometimes. I'm just like, oh, right. But if I were to just, you know, dream, you know, the next thing that I would love to do is long haul. Long haul was, like, something that I really wanted to touch. And I was, maybe this is, again, me dreaming, but I was really hoping to do it, you know, earlier in my career versus, like, towards the end, because a lot of pilots end up doing it, you know, closer to when they're about to retire. So
sure.
I'm very open to moving around the world, and I'm very open to you know, exposing myself to different environments. So it was definitely something that I was looking and actually kind of excited to look to, or like to apply for the next step of my career. So long haul is definitely something that I would love to do. And, you know, especially on the new 777X that was coming out, I would love to be able to do that now. Whether or not it happens, I don't know. It's really hard, but it would be truly amazing to do the long haul, because I don't necessarily, like, I'm not a cute homebody. Like, I don't necessarily want to, you know, have the house and the white picket fence and all that stuff. That's never really appealed to me. So I'm all for, you know, having those layovers in Morocco or wherever you're going, right? So, like, that would be a big appeal to me, and it always has. So if it can start happening, I would absolutely love that. That's definitely a goal of mine. I just, we'll have to see when, or, you know, if it occurs. So we'll have to see.
Well, I suspect that when there are medical interventions that are truly available, and everything from the treatment as well as vaccination, there's going to be a pent-up demand that's going to suddenly surge. The trick is going to be for all of us to survive, of course, in the interim period. It's a bit like, you know, being at cruise and having a twin flame out and wondering whether you have enough altitude to trade for distance, mm-hmm. you know, to get there. And neither of those scenarios are attractive, either the financial challenges people all around the world are facing or having a twin flame out. Mm-hmm. That's, as they said in Ghostbusters, that's bad. But I also think the industry will evolve and change a bit. There may be more cargo positions perhaps available, you know, downside and upside. The downside might be that there are fewer destination choices. The upside might be there are no passengers to deal with. or as we used to say, self-loading cargo. At Flight International. Taking all this into account, including what's going on in the world right now, Do you have any advice for others, perhaps especially young women who wish to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah. I'm even like, I don't know, I'm honored that I could be asked this question in the first place. So thank you.
Sure.
I think like going back to what I was mentioning kind of earlier, I think one of the biggest things that I've learned from this is definitely to have a backup plan of sorts, because we do know, and we've seen it, as you said, this isn't the first time, to have a backup plan of sorts, you know, plan B, because that consistency of work and your work stability, like that is a factor that needs to be considered in, you know, whether or not you want to do this long term. And, you know, for me, this is kind of hitting me now, unfortunately, because again, you know, I had the prior career of massage therapy, but in terms of an actual solid plan B, I'm figuring that, you know, right now, as so many of us are. So it's definitely something that, you know, I'm looking and I'm like, yeah, you know, I wish there's a part of me that I wish that I could have been a bit more, you know, prepared for this. It's just, you know, it's tough while you're doing it, because you've been studying for 10 years and you've been committed to this and you're like, well, plan B is not going to happen because I'm so focused on plan A, right? So I think that's an advice I would give to other women or to any pilot getting into this, is having a plan B, whether that's, you know, going to school first and getting a degree, or whether that's, you know, getting yourself in another like side business, you know, whether you're doing, you know, like a small business on the side, or you're getting into social media, whatever the case may be, just something else that you can kind of, you know, help yourself or fall back on, right? Like, I think that would be big, just as a learning experience that I've had. And then the other big thing that I would say to, for women is just like the mentorship aspect, to reach out to having that support, because it's something that I wish I definitely had, and it's available a lot more. It's a lot more accessible, especially if we were talking about the 99s earlier, like there wasn't a chapter where I was for a long time. So physically we couldn't meet up, you know, whereas nowadays everything is online. So there's a huge, you know, reach that barrier has been kind of, you know, removed at this point. So getting that mentorship and that group support, I think is also another piece of advice I'd give out for sure.
I think that's excellent advice. And when things were simpler in the world vis-a-vis the pandemic, one of the things that a lot of pilots looked at as an existential threat to their career was just their health changing for some reason. So everything that you've just said absolutely applies in that case, just to give somebody a plan B if suddenly they can't pass their medical exam.
Totally. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Even if there are jobs out there. So, you know, whether it's being able to be a dispatcher, getting an A&P, or, you know, if you want to stay in aviation, or if you want to lose a lot of money, start your own aviation business.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think that was very, very solid advice. And of course, there will be an aviation in some form in the future, and they're going to need talented, hardworking, dedicated people. And they should be people that look like society, you know. So if you're a little boy or a little girl, no matter what your background is, you know, you could be wearing four really cool bars on your shoulder, just like like Captain Emily does when she's flying. Where can people find and follow you and your work online? You're in multiple platforms, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Instagram, I'm at Pilot Emily. Same thing for YouTube. I'm trying to get some consistency out there and get some videos going. So at Pilot Emily as well there. I do have a Facebook page, and, you know, for if anybody has like questions that they want to ask as well, it's under the same. So definitely can be reached on all three of those platforms.
Well, needless to say, on the audio podcast and on this video, there will be links to those in the description below that you can click on. So please, folks, if you're curious, go do that. And I highly recommend that you do. She has a wonderful social media presence and shares her adventures. Like, for example, go look at the volcano pictures from the time in the DRC.
Yes.
Those look like they're something from a sci-fi movie, and they're beautifully executed. If you like hiking and or cats and or just flying, go follow all of those things. And I'm sure there's some really exciting content to come.
Yes, absolutely. I am also just refurbishing my website. I plan on having just more resources for people. So like some of the frequently asked questions that I get, you know, some flight training tips. So those articles will be back up and running. And same thing, pilotemily.com. So thank you so much for that.
Oh, of course. And when that gets updated, there'll be a link for that. If you just ping me, we'll put that in. Well, thank you so very much for joining me, and I hope that you'll come back and do this again sometime soon.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, the wheels are stopped and the chocks are in. Thank you so much for spending time aboard with us. Please be sure to subscribe and click the notification bell, leave a comment, give it a thumbs up or thumbs down, and rate the show on iTunes. All of that really helps. By subscribing and clicking the bell, you'll be sure to know when we do a live stream like a Q&A or post the next episode, which is an interview with talented aviation photographer Richard George. We talk plane spotting, aviation photography, and much more. If you're watching this sometime in the future, it may already be published. Look for a link on the end card that follows or in the description below. Want to ask a question or leave a comment I can answer or share in a future episode? Visit anchor.fm/aerospacenews and click the send voice message button. Who knows, maybe your comment or question will make it into a future show. Please, please support the show by joining our crew at aerospacenews.com/fans. Link in the description. If you are a creator in aviation, space, science, or STEM, you can get support from your fans with your own account. Just visit the site at that same address, and the link to become a creator is at the top of every page. My huge thanks again to Pilot Emily for being such a great guest. Links to her social media accounts are in the description below. And we will catch you next time, out there, on the leading edge.